The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is simply the best way there is to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China with our indispensable daily newsletter, our website, and our growing range of podcasts and videos. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you today from my home in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, formally opened in January 2016, headquartered in Beijing. What the organization does is all there in the name. It lends to Asian nations for investment in infrastructure. Listeners to this program doubtless remember the embarrassing missteps that the Obama administration took in trying without success to dissuade some of its allies from joining as founding members. These days, though, one hears very, very little criticism of the bank as the initial skepticism over its governance and its environmental standards and so forth, concerns over Beijing's control of the bank, have largely, if not entirely, subsided. But AIIB has been quite active, especially considering its relatively small capitalization and the small size of the organization itself, and during the COVID-19 pandemic has found a new and very important role for itself. Today, to talk about the state of the bank, I am joined by Sir Danny Alexander, Vice President and Corporate Secretary of the AIIB. Prior to joining the bank, he spent most of his adult life as a politician, winning a parliamentary seat in 2005 as a Lib Dem MP representing districts in Scotland, and becoming Chief of Staff to Lib Dem party leader Nick Clegg in 2008. During the years of the coalition with Cameron's Conservative Party, Sir Danny was appointed to Secretary of State for Scotland, but was very quickly promoted to become Chief Secretary of the Treasury. He lost his seat in Lib Dem rout in 2015, but don't feel bad for him. He is, after all, the only guest on this show to date to have had a beer named after him, and I believe the first knighted guest that we've had. Sir Danny Alexander, welcome to Seneca.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the introduction. I'm sure we'll come to the ginger rodent beer later.
Yeah, we have to. And I actually have to call out one other thing, is that you're a heavy metal fan, and listeners to this show will be sorely disappointed if we don't talk to that subject a little bit.
Right, since my teenage years, that's true.
You were chief secretary to the Treasury at the time when the U.S. was lobbying Australia, South Korea, and other countries that had been invited to join as founders just to not do so. I imagine you must have had some conversations with Jack Lew, who was then the U.S. Treasury Secretary, about this. Was this something you had been paying attention to? Because at that point, you hadn't been tapped for the bank yet, yeah?
Very much so. It was an important decision for the coalition. And, George Osborne and I were leading the Treasury for the two respective parties. And so we were the ones who were kind of examining closely what was going on, and decided, having looked at it, that we thought that the UK ought to join. And so we recommended that to our respective party leaders and colleagues. And, actually the decision to join the bank from the UK's point of view was one of the very last kind of important decisions that the coalition government made before the election, which you mentioned already, when I had was given the chance to seek alternative employment by the voters. Very much aware of it. We'd been watching it carefully. We'd been trying to get a sense of the substance of the proposals, and we were very interested in the idea of a new multilateral institution. And we thought that the kind of purpose about infrastructure investment was one that we believed was valid. And we also thought that, China taking a step to propose a multilateral institution where we favor multilateral governance, then we should with appropriate reassurances, support it. And by getting involved, we can, help to make sure that it operates properly as part of the rules-based system. That was our rationale. And you're right, there were many conversations with many other countries, including the US. I'm not going to go into the details, but yeah, you're right. And I guess some of those concerns you mentioned, was this bank going to be set up to try and undermine existing international standards, to operate in a way that, you know, competed unfairly with the World Bank or whatever? Would it be dominated by China, or would it be a genuinely multilateral institution? We took the view that it wouldn't be those things, and that by being part of it, we could help make sure that it was, you know, operated within proper international rules, proper international governance. My own view is that after you know, 4.5 years, we've proven the skeptics wrong.
A couple of years ago, I actually had the opportunity to sit down with another Danny, with Danny Russell, who is Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs. Yeah, you're acquainted with him. He was there during much of the second Obama term. He suggested that the warnings were along lines of, I mean, to use his colloquial American expression, you're buying a pig in a poke. That is, you know, you don't know what you're actually signing on to. You don't know anything. I mean, the wraps haven't been taken off this thing yet. Other American officials have in the time since AIIB got going suggested, you know, that it was their skepticism, it was all that scrutiny that it produced that prompted the bank to actually accept more international participation and establish such high standards for the ones. What do you make of that claim, and what did you know at the time that you and George Osborne decided that it was a good idea for the UK to go ahead and participate?
I mean, by the time we made the decision, it was pretty clear to us that this was heading in exactly the right kind of direction. You know, there were other countries like New Zealand, for example, who'd signed up to the negotiations much earlier. The process was quite transparent, so we could see the kind of, you know, draft documents that were being prepared, all of which seemed to us to be exactly the right kind of steps that you would expect in the formation of this. And it was very important to the UK, and I think also important to the other European countries who decided to join, that the governance was strong, the standards were high, and those things. And I would say that the views of those European countries who were considering whether to join and decided to join on those issues was very positive in getting the bank set up in the right way. But actually, the proposals that were there before we got involved were really good. You know, there was an American lawyer, Natalie Lichtenstein, who'd been tapped up as the chief counsel. You know, the lawyer basically writing these documents, someone with immense experience of multilateral institutions from her career in the World Bank, and, you know, it was clear that this was being taken incredibly seriously from the right perspective. Jin Lee Chun, who's now the president of the bank, but was then the head of the secretariat, also someone who we and many others, I think, had a lot of confidence in. And you know, having now worked with him for nearly 5 years as a colleague, I think that confidence is 100% justified. So, look, it was clear to me at that time it would not be possible for the US to join the AIIB. I mean, taking that through Congress at any time would be a complicated business. But, you know, other countries have to make up their own mind for their own reasons, and I think we made the right decision.
Just now you mentioned Natalie Lichtenstein, who had served, as you say, as inaugural general counsel for AIIB. And I think a lot of people have deservedly given her credit for the bank's very widely praised excellence in governance. I want to just give a shout out to my friend Nason Makbubi, who runs the University of Pennsylvania's Center for the Study of Contemporary China, their podcast. And he did an excellent interview with Natalie. I highly recommend anyone who's interested in digging into that to listen to that. Sir Danny, can you talk about some of the features that you think have made for good governance? What are some of the things that people aren't aware of that are in the charter of the AIIB?
Well, look, it's worth going back to the charter, to the Articles of Agreement, and actually, you know, you will see that when they were creating the charter, they were drawing on provisions that existed in other multilateral institutions. you know, with the benefit of being able to look at the experience of other international bodies, you're able to look at, well, what works well, where do we want to pick up the right lessons. But I think maybe the most important thing to say is that it's completely in line with the kind of governance approach, governance principles of all multilateral institutions. So, you know, we have a board of governors, which is the ultimate decision-making body. It's the finance ministers of the member countries. They take the most important decisions. You know, the most important decisions are protected by a very high voting threshold. So if you want to change the Articles of Agreement, for example, you need at least 75% of the shareholding to be willing to endorse such a change. We have a board of directors that operates, you know, by consensus, which has 12 members representing constituencies. The shares in the bank were shared out in a fair and equitable way related to GDP. One distinctive feature is that the Asian character of the bank, if you like, is exemplified by the fact that 75% of AIB is owned by the Asian member countries and 25% by the non-Asian countries. So, you know, you have China, India, Russia, Indonesia, Korea, Australia as major shareholders. And then outside Asia, countries like Germany, France, UK. Now, Canada has also joined more recently. So those processes are very strong. There are strong protections in terms of the non-political character of the institution, the high financial standards, the sound banking principles that we have to apply. You know, all those things come from the charter and basically say, this is how this bank is going to work. And of course, you got to take the document, you got to put it into practice, you got to make it real. But I think that, you know, the accountability and the scrutiny that we have through our board and through our commitments to transparency, openness, you know, mean that this bank is really, you know, run along, I think, to very high standards from a governance point of view.
Yeah, it seems to be the consensus. As I understand it, though, the AIIB has a structure where loan decisions, maybe, you know, obviously if you want to change the charter, you've got to go all the way to this board of directors, or actually above that. But the board of directors don't approve loan decisions, but actually the president does, right? That's actually quite...
You're right. It's
please, go ahead.
It's an unusual feature, but it's a little bit more nuanced than you described. So what we put in place is something called an accountability framework, where the board has delegated some of the decision-making power to the president. So projects below a certain size, when you're doing repeats of projects you've done before in certain countries, those things go to the president. But if it's the first project in a country, or the project is above a certain financial size or risk level, then the board will still decide it. And also the directors have a kind of call-in power. But I think it is an important thing because, in a sense, thinking about our governance, you've also got to look at, well, what have been the developments in governance in the private sector? And obviously, during the financial crisis and after the financial crisis, there was a lot of work done to look at, okay, how can governance of financial institutions be strengthened? So the board having clear ownership of the strategy and the policy, that's what it does in the AIB. The board also having clear ownership of the risk appetite of the institution. You know, so our board is one of the first among MDBs to adopt a risk appetite statement. Now that sounds, you know, that a bit vague, but it's very important because it's basically the document that says, okay, AIB, we're prepared to take risks in these areas, but not in these areas. And so that means that it's the shareholders who are taking the ownership in that space. That's important. And then on the projects, we say, okay, the board leads on policy and strategy. The board holds the president and the management accountable for our delivery against those things. And the board delegates operational decisions to the president unless certain features pertain, which make the projects, let's say, particularly risky
above a certain threshold,
or very important, or whatever. So, I think in that way, the division of labor between the board of directors and the management is much clearer. There's actually a much clearer line of accountability. We've also been I think one of the first multilateral institutions to formalise an annual performance evaluation of the president by the board of directors. Now, that's quite common practice in many kinds of institutions. We think it's appropriate in the AIB setting where you're delegating power to the president, so you've also got to strengthen the board's tools to hold you accountable for what you're doing.
So you've taken some good practices from the private sector in the aftermath of the financial crisis, and I imagine that this lets you be a little more nimble and responsive. And I think a lot of people would probably be surprised to learn how small you actually are as an organization. You're a very lean operation. I think it's only 300 some people. Is that correct?
It is. I mean, I think the number of staff is a slightly misleading guide because we're still very much in the kind of early growth phase of the bank. So, you know, we have today 320 professional staff plus some consultants and, you know, locally hired administrative people. That will grow over time. Of course it will. It has to. You know, we're still maybe a third or a little more than a third of the financing volumes that will be pertain when we're you know, fully mature. But I think what you said is right. It's the philosophy of the bank. You know, we talk about being lean, clean, and green. Sometimes lean, clean, and mean is how it comes out, but it's lean, clean, and green that we mean. And, you know, that means that we're, you know, trying to avoid becoming bureaucratic, to becoming slow, becoming kind of sclerotic in some of the ways that you work. But look, we also have to be humble about that. This is still a work in progress. We're still building up this institution. So, you know, the management is really focused on saying, let's build a lean, agile, responsive institution. But, you know, those things are easy to say and hard to do. So we're trying our best and we're working towards that. But, you know, you see in many walks of life, not just MDBs, but, you know, I was in the British government, for goodness sake, you know, these, you know, big institutions can, you know, become bureaucratic if you're not careful. And so that's kind of what we have to avoid. But I think at this stage, we also have to be a bit humble about our achievements so far.
You're lean in another sense, too. I think a lot of listeners would probably be surprised to learn how relatively little you actually have under management right now. I think it's only $18 billion, if I'm not mistaken. Is that about right?
So we have the capital of the bank. So we have just under $20 billion. I think it's like 19.4, which is paid in by our members. Mm-hmm. And then in addition, on top of that, we have another $80 billion, which is called callable capital. So it's not paid in, but it's part of the capital base of the bank. So we would say there's $100 billion of capital has gone into the bank, and then our lending so far is about $19 billion. I think I'm just checking the latest figures because we had some further approvals just day before yesterday. So yeah, so in our first kind of 4.5 years, we've approved financing of $19.1 billion US dollars. That's 83 projects in 23 member countries. So look, we're trying to build it up carefully, right? Because when we're you know, part of making this bank work is to make sure the governance is strong, the standards are high, that the projects are really carefully scrutinized before you agree the financing. And that means that you need to develop good practices, you need to hire good people, and all that takes time. So, you know, by the time the bank is with the capital we have, by the time the AIB is at a sort of steady state, we'll be doing maybe $15 billion a year of financing. But that won't be for another 5 or 10 years. You know, so each year we're increasing. And obviously this year, with the tragedy of the COVID-19 crisis, we've really upped a lot of our lending for crisis response to a lot of our member countries.
I actually want to focus in on that quite a bit. But before that, I do have one other question that I'm sure you get constantly, which is the confusion between the AIIB and the Belt and Road Initiative. You've probably encountered that a lot. People somehow assume that AIIB is part of BRI. Can you set this straight? Is there any formal relationship between, you know, Xi Jinping's signature BRI and AIIB?
No, there's no formal relationship at all. AIB is a multilateral institution. That means we follow our own strategies, our own policies, which are set by all of our members coming together through the governance bodies that I mentioned. We're answerable to all of the members. So our bank was set up with a mandate to invest in infrastructure to support the sustainable development of Asia. That means included within that is connectivity projects, but connectivity projects that meet our own standards and our own project qualification criteria, not projects that tick a box of or have a label, whether it's BRI or Blue Dot Network or whatever it may be. We judge each project on its own merits according to, you know, is it economically beneficial? Is it financially sound? Does it satisfy the environmental and social safeguards? Does it have open procurement? We look at the debt sustainability position of the places that we're lending to. We don't look at these labels. And you know, it's the projects come to us from the member countries themselves. Or from private companies. We can also support private investments. So, you know, right now, and I suspect this will continue to be the case for a long time, India is by far our largest borrower. They're not notably enthusiastic about Belt and Road, but they're the second largest shareholder. They're completely committed to AIB. They are very well practiced at dealing with multilateral institutions, and that's a very, very important and good relationship for us.
You raised another issue I wanted to bring up, India, but let's get to this first. This spring, as you said, while the pandemic was engulfing many countries around the world, the AIIB announced a $5 billion facility to address public health needs during the pandemic. You started with a $350 million loan to China, but you've since announced loans to numerous countries. Was pandemic response actually part of the original thinking with AIIB, or was this something that you've had to somehow improvise a bit with?
It's something that we've had to think on our feet. We've had to be very agile and respond to circumstances. You know, in a crisis, international institutions like us have a responsibility to step up and offer support to members where they need it. So we're doing, you know, we're providing financing for things that we would never have expected to do when we started out, right? So some of the lending has been, you know, straightforward lending to support the budgets of countries who are under stress.
For PPE and whatnot.
Yeah, so for health, for economic resilience, for liquidity reasons, you know, and that kind of lending, especially lending which is, you know, basically about supporting the budget of a country in difficulties, that's not something we'll do on a regular basis. That's purely crisis. It's not something where we have particular expertise because it's not part of our kind of regular remit. So we're teaming up with the Asian Development Bank and the World Bank to do that together with them. Health, we hadn't invested in any health projects. Now, health is part of infrastructure, but we hadn't focused on social infrastructure. So we've got into supporting some health investments perhaps much earlier in the life of the AIB than we'd expected to. So that's about saying, you know, we want to be and we've got to be responsive to what our clients need. And right now, as you know, many countries, almost every country in the world is under huge pressure to manage the disease, to respond to the health crisis, but also to deal with the massive economic impacts. And so, it's, you know, for us, we've got to stand with our member countries and help them out through that period. And that's what we're trying to do. So we the facility is $5 to $10 billion US. And if more is needed, we'll add more to it. That's a big chunk. And honestly, much more financing than we'd been expecting to do this year.
Just out of curiosity, if you could maybe rattle off some of the names of the recipient countries.
India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Mongolia, Indonesia, and there's a whole bunch more in the pipeline.
Impressive. And you've been coordinating, as you say, with ADB, with IMF, with the World Bank on crisis response.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, maybe just to roll back one stage, which is, We've worked very hard to build very good partnerships with other multilateral institutions. So right from the start of the AIIB, co-financing projects together with the World Bank, with the ADB, with the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, that was part of our idea, And it helped us a lot, but it also, with large scale infrastructure projects, helps to share some of the risks. And when the crisis broke, a lot of coordination among the presidents of these institutions at my level, at working level, because all these MDBs, these multilateral development banks, have slightly different remits, they have slightly different memberships, but we have a responsibility to make sure that in total the support we're providing is what the members need, and so there's been a lot of coordination about that, and I'm sure there will continue to be, because once you're through this immediate emergency phase, then given the scale of the economic damage seems to be greater than the financial crisis in 2008 in many places, then further support will be needed for economic recoveries as well. So we're not even really into that stage yet.
So recently, criticism of the AIIB has been notable, I think, chiefly for its absence. But even now, during the Trump administration, when just about anything that can be in some way tied to China has come in for real, vitriolic abuse, there's been relatively little directed at your bank. But has the precipitous decline over the last 4 or 5 years in U.S.-China relations had any impact on the way you've been able to conduct business? Have the broader geopolitics of the U.S.-China relationship had any impact that you can talk about?
No, not really. I mean, it's the truth. I mean, the U.S. is not a member of our bank, though, of course, I should say. The U.S. is welcome to apply to join. The door is open for new members. I'm not sure how likely that is right now, but the door is open. But, we started with 57 members. Now we have 102 members in the AIIB. Those countries have all joined because they're committed to making this institution work. And so our focus is on how do we build an institution that draws from all of that experience from all of those countries and provides the kind of support that we want to provide. And so I'd say the main impact actually over the last couple of years has been the economic one on some of our members. So we publish research every year looking at the Asian infrastructure market. And it's very striking both in the research we published in early 2019 and the research we published early this year, that you could see an impact, particularly on private sector investment in infrastructure in the major infrastructure markets in Asia, caused by the trade tensions, heightened perception of geopolitical risks. And so that's having an effect. It's having an effect on the willingness of private investors to go into infrastructure in some places. It's a reminder of how important crowding in private sector investment is, and it's also a reminder of the importance of having organizations like the AIIB, which can take a longer term perspective, which can give a bit of security to other financiers. And certainly, we're motivated to significantly increase the proportion of our business which is in the private sector over the coming years.
So lowering the risk profile to bring in institutional investors.
Precisely.
Into infrastructure projects. Okay. Talk about some of your infrastructure priorities, broadly speaking, across the region. You'd say you do all this research. What are you finding that what categories of infrastructure are? I mean, I know that it's very country specific, but are there any generalizations you could make across, say, South Asia right now, where you're focusing so much of your lending?
I mean, we've identified basically four areas that we think need to be prioritized, and where prioritizing those areas is meeting needs and demands within the kind of clients of AIIB. So number one is what we call sustainable infrastructure. In other words, infrastructure which is environmentally beneficial, whether it's renewable energy to help our members meet their commitments under the Paris Agreement, whether it's urban transportation systems to get cars off the road and get people moving around more safely in big cities, water and sanitation projects which have health and environmental benefits, those kind of things. That'd be one kind of category. Secondly is connectivity. There is a big need in many parts of Asia for infrastructure that helps to enhance connectivity both within and between countries to support trade, to support the movement of goods and people and so forth. And so, we finance some road projects, we've got railway projects that we're looking at, we haven't financed any yet. We financed a port project in Oman. We financed some telecommunications infrastructure. The third one, which we've literally just concluded discussions about our strategy on, is digital. So, of course, commonplace, and you know, even more so now after this crisis, digital infrastructure is going to be absolutely critical to the future of countries in Asia. And yet, there are huge digital divides, you know, between low-income countries and the quality of their telecommunications and digital infrastructure, and the better-off countries, even within countries between urban and rural. And so, for a multilateral institution with a public purpose, we see a valid role for our investment to help bridge some of those divides. And then, lastly, private sector, private capital mobilization, and where for AIB, one area where I think we've been quite innovative has been projects to try and enhance the sustainability, the environmental sustainability of capital markets in Asia. You know, ESG rating, environmental social governance rating of bonds, which is commonplace in Europe and I guess the US, but not so much in Asia. Likewise, climate bonds. So we've launched portfolios in both cases to try and develop markets in this region to help more companies benefit from those kind of instruments.
You've actually just raised a bond, speaking of bonds, your Panda bond. There are a lot of sort of neo-Cold Warrior types who suspect that the real purpose of the AIIB is that you're part of some master plan to supplant the dollar with the RMB as the de facto global currency. When I've heard that in the past, I'd like to remind people that you actually only have dollar funds. But that's not going to be true now. You're actually going to be doing some RMB investing because you've raised this Panda bond in RMB. Is that correct?
Right. So the you're right to say our capital is all in US dollars, and the vast majority of our financing so far has been in US dollars. We're increasingly looking to diversify into other currencies, local currencies in the region. So this year we issued a US dollar bond, which raised, I think, $3 billion US dollars. And then you're right, we launched our first Panda bond, which was specifically targeted at raising RMB, where, as you said, we have a health-related, COVID-related project in China, which is denominated at RMB, and so it helps us to get the money in there. But, you know, like all international financial institutions, we're going to be tapping lots of different markets in order to diversify our funding sources, make sure we can get the best price. Because in the end, you know, we're a AAA rated institution. We need to leverage that rating to be able to pass on the cheapest financing we can to our members, especially the low and middle income countries in Asia. So in the years to come, you'll see AIB doing financing in a whole bunch of different currencies in the region, according to what's needed.
I mentioned that I wanted to bring up India. India has, of course, been the largest recipient of loans from you to date. It is a member, but it's also been very skeptical of BRI and has been, of course, in a nasty spat right now with China over the Ladakh area of Kashmir. Are loans to India in any way imperiled right now by the situation with China? Has that had any impact?
Absolutely not. No change. Yeah. We don't look at political issues. We only look at the economic issues. India has big needs for infrastructure. It has very good capacity for developing good quality projects. They're great to work with. So, you know, we're very pleased with the way our portfolio is developing there. And so, no, look, as a multilateral institution, we look at the projects. That's the only thing we look at. We don't look at the politics. And we have a really strong pipeline of great projects in India. And of course, you know, India is the second largest shareholder in the AIB, so they're an important part of the bank. You know, they were ready when the bank started with projects coming down the tracks. That was great. As time's gone on, we've seen other countries. We've been able to build up our portfolio in places like Bangladesh, Indonesia, Turkey, and so, you know, you'll see other countries increase. But India is going to be a major market for AIB.
So the AIIB is looking to get the private sector more engaged, and you've come up with a kind of framework for institutional investors who are looking to invest in more green and more sustainable projects, infrastructure projects specifically. Can you dig in a little bit more about this push? What are you nudging investors toward right now? Is it, as you said, things like renewables and what about things like smart cities or
So all of that, I mean, just maybe to take one step back, first of all, to say
sure.
The green commitment is really built into the AIIB. You know, our bank was created just a few weeks after the Paris Agreement was signed. You know, all of our members,
right.
All of our members are signed up to the Paris Agreement. And, you know, we see that as a major strand of our activities. So one side of it is investing in projects, whether it's public sector or private sector. And the areas you mentioned, like renewable energy, like smart cities, you know, urban transport, you know, subways, light rail schemes, this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, those are areas where we see a huge business that we can develop that's going to really benefit a lot of places. But at the same time, we also want to develop capital markets in Asia so that there are more financing tools available for companies who are meeting or investing to high environmental standards. So the concept of ESG, environmental social governance ratings, is you know, quite well understood. It's not so well developed in Asia. So we set up an ESG bond portfolio. A company called Aberdeen Standard is running that for us, $500 million, to buy ESG rated bonds of companies to help develop information tools in the Asian context that allow people to have more transparency on those kind of instruments. And hopefully that will help to develop those markets, so not just for the AIIB specific project, but for other investors also to become involved. Because we know from a lot of the climate related discussions particularly that getting financial markets to get their head around the importance of climate investment and the need to mobilize finance more broadly for those objectives is important. And we think that you know, that's one example of something where, you know, AIIB funds can help to catalyze, we hope, something much broader.
I have to give a shout out to Calvin Queck, one of your colleagues there,
right,
who was the person who actually put me on to introduced me to you folks in the hopes that we could do a show together. And he, of course, came to you from Greenpeace and is a very, very committed environmentalist. One last question for you before we move on to recommendations. You recently closed nominations for the upcoming AIIB presidential election. There weren't any additional nominations. It looks like Jin Liqun is going to run unopposed. Can you talk about Jin Liqun as a leader? He was formerly at CIC, very well regarded in the world of finance. Tell me about him and his leadership style at the bank.
So Jin is a remarkable human being. He's, as you say, he's got great experience, you know, both from Chinese government, but also he was on the board of the World Bank. He was a vice president of the Asian Development Bank, as well as the CIC experience. So he brings all of that to bear. And I think, you know, he is personally very highly committed to multilateralism, to having an institution that runs according to the highest standards of international governance. So it's really a 21st century institution. And he brings that into everything that we do. Also, we talked about the lean philosophy earlier. That's something particularly dear to his heart. He doesn't want to see waste in the way the bank runs. But, you know, I often find in my discussions with him, I could just as easily be talking about Shakespeare as sustainable finance, because, you know, he's a very accomplished scholar of English literature. Indeed, he's translated some of the works of Shakespeare into Chinese. So, quite
that
something, right?
No,
that is quite something. And so, you know, really someone with a deep hinterland in many areas of culture, and therefore, you know, brings that broader perspective as well as his international experience to setting up this bank. And, you know, it couldn't have happened this way without his work and his leadership.
Well, unfortunately, I won't be able to hold forth on Shakespeare well with you, but I can talk a little bit about two things that I do like, which are beer and heavy metal. Tell us about the ginger rodent beer.
So that's a good one. In I think it was 2011, there was a Labour Party politician called Harriet Harman, who made an attack on me when I was in the government, comparing me to a ginger rodent, and this got a certain amount of media coverage. And there's a local brewery in my constituency, the Cairngorm Brewery, makes absolutely wonderful beer. They rang up and said, look, we'd like to have a bit of fun with this. So they brewed a beer, they bottled it, called it Ginger Rodent, with a nice picture on the cover. And I think for a while it sold pretty well. Good hoppy flavour. Harriet was good enough to see the funny side, and I got them to serve this beer in the bar of the House of Commons, and we went down and we went down there and pulled some pints together. So it was in the end, you know, very friendly.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's just great. The other thing, in a Telegraph interview, you did mention that you have an affinity for heavy metal music. I want to get into that with you maybe during the recommendation segment of our program. But let me first a brief message about how our listeners can help the podcast. Hey, cynical listeners. I'm really grateful to all of you who've stepped up and donated or subscribed during our drive. As you know, things are in a perilous state right now with U.S.-China relations, and it feels like the middle ground is disappearing really fast. I still believe that a deeper understanding of China is urgently needed, so help us get the word out about the podcast and help us keep going, because these things do cost money. If you think this program adds some valuable perspectives and helps to restore a little sanity, if you want us to keep fighting the good fight, then show your support by going to podcast.supchina.com. That's podcast.supchina.com. And help us out however you can. From our podcast team and all of SupChina, we thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your contribution. Okay, now on to recommendations. First, Sir Danny, it's true, you are indeed a metal fan. What bands do you like, and have you had a chance to check out any local Chinese heavy metal?
It's true, I am. Ever since my teenage years, my tastes date back to probably mostly to the bands I was listening to in the 1980s. So I had the chance to go and see Metallica, for example, in London. I think it was in, I can't remember, 1989 or 1990.
Wow. Priest and Maiden and
all, yeah, exactly. And you stuff, know, yeah. The lot of that British stuff. So. Yeah, I mean, I've probably become a bit more eclectic in my time, broadening from beyond, you know, metal to other rock music. But I still listen to Metallica sometimes. And then Louise Mensch, who was a MP when I was in Parliament, is married to Lars Ulrich, the drummer. So
that's right.
You know,
poor thing.
But in answer to your question, I haven't really got into any of the local bands here yet until you gave me some recommendations.
Good.
So I downloaded some of the Mongolian influenced music.
Oh yeah, that stuff is great.
Amazing. And one band that caught my eye was Tengger Cavalry.
Fantastic.
Amazing.
Music. Yeah.
The music to ride horses to over the endless grasslands
and
of Mongolia.
Slay some innocent sedentary agrarian people while you're at it. I think that works too. I've actually recommended that band as well on the show. Ego Fall is another one, and Nine Treasures. Definitely check out Nine Treasures. They actually, I believe they won the Battle of the Bands at Wacken, the open air festival in Germany, the year that we went in 2013. I don't know if they won, if they were the second runner up or something, but they're a fantastic band. They're called
Nine Treasures.
Nine Treasures. Okay. Yeah. Jobal. Nine Treasures. Check them out.
Great. I've got a recommendation as well then. That's fantastic.
Yeah. No, that's, so your recommendation, I will note down as Tengger Cavalry. It's a terrific band. That's fantastic. I'm going to give mine. Somebody asked me to share cocktail recipes, not beer, but I'm going to go for another form of alcohol. I'm going to recommend a slightly modified version of the Sazerac, which is my favorite cocktail. It's, you know, the New Orleans classic. The Sazerac usually calls for a sugar cube to begin with, and then you dot it with some bitters, but I skip that. I substitute two dashes of Luxardo maraschino liqueur, which is a very useful thing to have around in quantity. So in a mixing glass or a cocktail shaker, two dashes of Luxardo, three dashes of Peychaud's bitters, absolutely crucial, two dashes of Angostura bitters, 2 ounces of rye and 1 ounce of bourbon. I like actually to use this high rye bourbon, that is made by an American, company called Redemption. It's a great, great, high rye bourbon. So 3 ounces of that. Stir it with ice, strain it into an old fashioned glass that's been rinsed with, well, ideally absinthe, but any kind of anise based liqueur works. Zest some lemon peel on that, and you're good to go. It's an amazing drink. Highly recommended as you're listening to the Seneca podcast. Enjoy that. And Sir Danny, thank you so much again for taking the time. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much indeed. I'll go and make the cocktail now. It's evening time in Beijing, so I'm not sure I have all the ingredients, but I'll see if I can get somewhere close to it.
All right, improvise. And there's some good bars that make some very good cocktails in your area. So right. I hope you enjoy that. We'll be back in touch again. Thank you so much.
Good to talk to you. Okay. Thank you very much indeed.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SupChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@supchina.com, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SupChina News, and make sure to check out our other podcasts in the network, including the China in Africa podcast and the Pan Daily Tech Buzz China. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.